The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. This year, 2024, is an election year in America, a presidential election year. And so we will be doing two podcasts a week rather than our usual one because we want to and because we know you can't get enough Americano in your life. I am delighted to be joined today by Rob Henderson, who is the author, the best-selling author, I should say, of Troubled, a memoir of foster care, family and social class, which is a brilliant and very harrowing book. And Rob is also very well known now for being the coiner, if that's the right term, the coiner of the term luxury beliefs. And Rob, you are probably sick to death of explaining what luxury beliefs is. So I think I'd start by, let me try and say it, and then if I get it wrong, you can sort of correct me. Luxury beliefs are opinions which upper-class people wear as kind of baubles to signal to others that they are upper-class. They have effectively replaced sort of jewellery in the 17th or 18th century as ways in which people can show to other members of their class that they hold these opinions. And often these opinions are almost deliberately aimed at causing the working class's pain.
So that's right. The luxury beliefs do elevate the status of those who hold them, especially in their peer groups, in these sort of rarefied upper segments of society. It confers status to those people to express these viewpoints. And then as a consequence, it does often cause harm to people sort of lower down the socioeconomic ladder. Sometimes it's intentional. I think certain people do hold these views with malicious intent, but I think most people don't really think that deeply about it. It's more ignorance than malice. But I still think that people who hold beliefs, luxury beliefs, should be held responsible for doing so, because if you are an influential and affluent and privileged member of society, that you do hold some responsibility to ensure that the views that you're propagating throughout the culture and attempting to implement into policy don't cause undue harm to people who aren't in the same fortunate position as yourself.
And two examples of luxury beliefs that I can think of are, let's say, that drugs should be entirely legalized, or that monogamy is an outdated concept. Were those be two reasonably good examples, do you think?
Yeah, I cite both of those and describe, you know, the whole luxury beliefs framework and the sociological ideas and empirical psychology undergirding it in my book. And I use those two as examples that, you know, if you were to legalize or decriminalize all hard drugs, you know, often that does, because, I mean, it's not just the individual who is oftentimes inflicting undue harm on themselves, but those around them. We are not just sort of isolated, atomized individuals, but, you know, I'm speaking from my own experiences growing up in poverty, in the foster care system, in kind of working class communities in California. And typically, the reason why kids were taken from home and placed into care is because their parents were involved in hard drugs and had severe difficulties with addiction. And so and as a result, there was neglect or abuse and children were placed in out-of-home care. And, you know, we're sort of seeing the consequences of decriminalization of hard drugs. Oregon, the state of Oregon, decriminalized drugs in 2020. And recently, they're now introducing legislation to recriminalize hard drugs after this 4-year failed experiment where, you know, you have people overdosing and dying in the streets and causing all kinds of sort of havoc, especially in Portland and in more metropolitan areas, where you just see a lot of suffering and a lot of pain sort of out in the open. And so the other example you mentioned, family, sort of denigrating and downplaying the importance of marriage and family and stability. Look, the number one predictor of upward social mobility in the US and in the UK is being raised by two married parents. And so if you care about sort of helping people and assisting people to elevate themselves out of poverty, out of low income environments, then one thing you could do is promote and cultivate stable relationships, safe and secure and committed family structures that prioritize the well-being of kids in those environments to improve their lot in life. And so both of those are luxury beliefs.
Well, I obviously got carried away earlier when I was saying that people hold these opinions almost deliberately to hurt the working class. But I think where I was going with that is something you've talked about a bit, which is this old idea about the way class works and upper class or upper middle class thinking works, which is that you hold opinions deliberately to irritate the vulgarians. And so therefore, if the masses or common people find your opinions obnoxious, they are validated.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've written about this and spoken about this. I've read quite a bit, mostly primarily about the class structure in the U.S. You know, the ruling class in America from roughly the mid 19th to the mid 20th century were the WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And there was a great book on WASPs by Michael Knox Barron a couple of years ago, and he describes how high WASPs, the sort of the most prominent and influential members of this rarefied segment of society, would support movements and causes and ideals in part because it would irritate the vulgarians, the unwashed masses. And that is a sort of a signifier that if conventional opinion is X, then a very good way to distinguish yourself as someone who's outside of the unwashed masses, sort of above it, is to hold a contrary opinion. And if that opinion upsets the masses, all the better, because it just indicates just how different you are from them.
Yes. And I suppose one thing I struggle with in your work is the idea of elites, because I mean, when we're talking about these luxury beliefs, then they aren't just held by elites, are they? They are aspirational. You might hold luxury beliefs in public to actually make yourself more socially mobile, to make yourself more acceptable to a university educated group and so on. So it's a large elite, is it not?
Well, of course, like with any concept in social theory, it's not going to be airtight. There aren't going to be rigid boundaries. By analogy, Prada is a luxury brand, but you will occasionally see middle or lower middle class people or people lower down the socioeconomic ladder wearing Prada. There are outlets and there are stores and there are ways to obtain luxury brands. But by and large, the reason why it's a luxury brand is because the people who wear it are disproportionately affluent and well-resourced. And it's the same with luxury beliefs. They're disproportionately held by people who attend expensive universities and are born into comparative advantage. And, you can adopt those views and you can attempt to, disguise yourself or break into sort of higher segments of society, higher strata in society. But it's difficult to do. It's one thing to just express the opinion, but there are layers to it. I draw a lot in the book on this idea of cultural capital by the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu from the mid 20th century. And, he writes about how cultural capital in his day in the mid 20th century was about having sort of arcane and intricate knowledge about wine and art and furniture and history and travel and geography and exotic locales. And so, if you were an upwardly mobile person or an aspiring elite back then, it's one thing to say that you like, certain kinds of wine. But if asked why, you better be able to communicate the language. Otherwise, you'll give yourself away. And so today, if you were to say, we should defund the police, and someone asks you why, and you say, because cops are bad, you give yourself away as someone who hasn't actually absorbed the requisite knowledge. you know, you're supposed to be able to describe in intricate detail about the importance of redirecting resources into social workers and violence interrupters and, you know, cite stats about police harm and brutality. And you have to communicate as, oh, this person either went to an expensive university or runs in the circles where, you know, on the sort of vanguard of these beliefs in order to identify yourself as someone who is a member of the luxury belief class.
Yes. And is it a war on common sense in two senses, in the sense that common sense is common and easily accessible and understandable to people who are rational?
Yeah, I mean, I had this professor when I was at Yale who liked to say, you know, common sense is like air. The higher you go, the thinner it gets. Yeah. And there is something about sort of being far removed from everyday difficulties and struggles and trying to make ends meet, trying to pay your bills, trying to, you know, stay safe in an environment that isn't gated, that is, you know, sort of closer to threat and danger and peril. And, you know, once those everyday realities are stripped, you can sort of live in a more abstract and theoretical world, and you can start to play around with ideas, which can be fun as a thought experiment, but when you try to implement those into reality, a reality that you have no contact with, then often people who do live in that reality will suffer while you get to escape the consequences. This is kind of a difficulty with the luxury beliefs ideas, because the people who wield the most influence on policy and in culture and economics and so on, when those ideas go catastrophically awry, the people who develop those ideas and policies and so forth are the least likely to suffer the consequences of them.
I think you've expressed some irritation before your concern anyway, that your book is going to be sort of fetishized by the elite in the way perhaps that J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy was, in that it's sort of, it's picked up as a sort of, oh, this is an interesting insight. And then eventually, you know, you might be turned into a Netflix movie or something and everybody just moves on. am I correct in saying that that's one of your concerns?
My story, though, I mean, my story is just very different than his, which becomes very apparent, I think, early on, because the early chapters of my book focus on my early life in foster care, which was something that, you know, it's just a kind of a memoir that most people don't encounter, because most people who live through the foster care system, they don't end up in a position later in life where publishers are asking them to write books. You know, a lot of people in foster care end up homeless or severely addicted to substances, and their lives look very bleak. And I try to communicate some of those stories to the best of my ability. But, you know, I'm hoping that my book will have, you know, some degree of staying power, and that, you know, enough people with influence in society will read it, and even if they don't implement new policies, they'll at least second guess themselves or reconsider some of the harmful policies that they currently support or may potentially support in the future.
Yes, I'm sure that's right. I'm sure they will and they should. I just suppose, you know, luxury beliefs are very self-inoculatory. It's very hard to puncture that bubble. I wanted to ask you also about the international nature of luxury beliefs, in the sense that you have a very highly mobile, highly affluent elite who are able to move from place to place to place and mingle with other people of similar stature in different cities in the developed world. And they share their opinions this way, and this perhaps hardens this sort of progressive, Surab Amari called it Sado progressivism, I saw yesterday.
that's
very Surab. But they're able to sort of harden their opinions against the obvious flaws them, because they have other rich people in other cities that they talk to, and they can feel like they're part of an elite, and that hardens it.
Yeah, you know, there is that concern about the rootlessness of, you know, any given individual society. They will have, you know, their elites that are more mobile and travel more frequently and interact with elites in other countries and form a consensus and lose sight of the preferences of the voting majority in their home countries. And I think, you know, this is one major reason why there has been this in the last, I guess by now, almost decade or so of this sort of populist uprising in many countries is because voters, ordinary people, are understandably upset that the elites don't seem to be focusing on their concerns and spend more time sort of mingling with one another.
Yes. I suppose what I'm saying is that, you know, travel is always meant to open the mind. But for our affluent upper classes, travel can help close the mind in a way because it means they don't have to focus on the societies that they're actually living in.
Yeah, well, most elites, when they travel, you know, they're not traveling to villages and rundown parts of France or Malaysia or what have you, right? They're going to Paris or they're going to Kuala Lumpur. Or they're hanging out with their, you know, the elites in those respective countries. And I think many elites do tell themselves the story that they're open-minded and global and worldly and so on. But, you know, it's funny. I mean, a lot of elites spend more time in capital cities in other countries than they do in impoverished areas of their home country. You know, you could spend more time sort of learning about where you live and the people there and what their concerns are instead of what the concerns of elites in other countries are.
And I wanted to ask you, I'm afraid, about Donald Trump, because I don't know if you saw yesterday, but as Biden went to, Biden's been on a tour of Arizona and Nevada, and he's talking to Latino voters and saying, this guy despises you, talking about Donald Trump. And Trump's reply was to post this highly amusing advert, which is a sort of pastiche. Have you seen it? In the case of Biden, I'm going to try and sing it now, which will be very embarrassing. But it's like a pastiche Latino advert going, you know, l'economia por Trump, and you know all this sort of stuff. And it's typically Trumpian in that it actually annoys everybody who probably isn't Latino, who's sort of you know, holds luxury beliefs. Who hold luxury beliefs, I'm sure, because they'll think, oh, what a sort of mocking, cheap pastiche of Latin culture and so on. And yet, Latinos seem to actually really like Trump. Increasingly, he has a majority of their support. And this, for me, I wanted to ask you in relation to that, I wanted to ask you, do you think Trump is the perfect revenge signal of the masses towards luxury beliefs?
If your attempt is to get revenge, then yes, then maybe Trump is the perfect instrument to do that. I don't know if revenge is the right goal, but I understand it. You know, I understand. Like, I mean, it's very interesting, sort of the shifts around Trump. I mean, you've probably seen some of the polls that he actually is losing support. More and more support among white college-educated voters, but he's increasing support among working-class, like non-college-educated Latino and Asian voters, and Black voters as well. And so there's something to be said here about, you know, a lot of our political divide is based on political affiliation, Democrats and Republicans, but I think a lot of it is also explained by growing class divides. And you can see this with, you know, sort of, you know, you can see the difference between like elite Latinos who want to promote new labels like Latinx or Latin with an E at the end. Whereas when you see survey data, the vast majority of Latinos in the U.S. Have either never heard of those terms or don't like them. And they themselves sort of within that community, there seems to be a divide, you know, so I think that, you know, a lot of this can go a long way to explaining this diverging support by class lines for Trump.
Yes, and the fact that Trump's support comes from this idea among them that he's a unity candidate, that in fact, you know, all the divisiveness of DEI and so on, which is a lot in the news this year, Trump is a good antidote to that because in his way, he levels the playing field.
Yeah, I mean, he does give people who don't feel like they have much influence or sway or representation in elite circles that, you know, it's nice to, you know, if you're a member of these communities, you can sort of see someone who, you know, like I once read this line, you know, there've been sort of endless think pieces and takes on Trump since 2016. But one line that stood out to me was something like, Trump is the kind of person that poor and working class people would imagine themselves to be if they got rich. Like they would, whatever, buy a, you know, live in a golden skyscraper, but still eat McDonald's, but have a private jet, but marry a supermodel. Like, you know, that's like a fantasy. And I could see like a lot of poor people, even if, you know, they, like Trump isn't poor, but he is sort of aspirational in a sense. And he feels, like a wish fulfillment or something. Like, you know, if you see, I don't know, the CEO of an investment bank, or you see, I mean, honestly, even someone like Joe Biden, in some sense, is like a regular guy. And I think that helps to explain why he won in 2020, was because ordinary voters could see themselves in him as well. But when you see a sort of typical representative of the professional managerial class, you know, the president of an elite university, or the CEO of an investment bank, and so on and so forth, you know, as a working class person, you don't think like, I want that job someday. I want to be like that person who went to expensive colleges and ticked the right boxes and, you know, behaves in this way and says all the right things and promotes the right slogans. But then they see someone like Trump, who still speaks and acts, you know, in that sort of populist everyman way, they can see themselves in that.
And he's, I would say, uniquely American. In a way, and that the luxury beliefs you're talking about, the snobbery that you're talking about, is quite inherited from Europe in many ways, and America, is new to class warfare compared to Europe in many ways. And I mean, I wonder what you think about that, because Trump's appeal is an almost a sort of 80s nostalgia for an America which didn't have these class hang-ups that you now seem to have.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, we still have some denial in the U.S. around whether class boundaries even exist, and we like to believe in this ideal of egalitarianism, that anyone can make it, and you know, I think like the boundaries are less rigid than they are in the U.K. or in continental Europe, but they're around, and they've, I think, been sort of hardening over time. And, you know, I mean, it's funny, like Trump himself, he has sort of the qualities of both sides. You know, he has a degree from an Ivy League institution. He was born into wealth. He did run in the same circles as a lot of elites for a time, although he did sort of have a foot in more sort of mainstream pop culture with wrestling and so on, and reality TV. But, you know, he also had, he was friendly with the Clintons and politicians and so on. And so he was, maybe in some ways he is that figure who somehow has a bit of everything, and perhaps that's part of his appeal.
Part of his appeal for the people that like him is the idea that he's tremendously hardworking, that he never stops working. And I wonder to what extent that plays into the kind of class warfare that's going on, because there is a broader perception among the masses now that there is a leisure class. I think you talk about Veblen a lot. That was an idea that's been kicking around for ages, but now has percolated to the masses, that there is now a leisure class that don't really work and don't have to. They just get into the right schools and they just look after each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a bit of that. It's sort of high variance in elite institutions, where I've met very hardworking people who graduate from elite institutions, more so kind of, you know, in the American context, upper middle class people who are still striving and still have sort of high ambitions. Whereas, yeah, the sort of legacy admits of the Ivy League, and people who come from and sort of inherit great wealth, you know, they spend all of their time sort of jet setting and opining and getting appointed to various boards through, you know, no serious effort of their own. And I can see how that would be, you know, that would be irritating to people, especially people who have day jobs, who clock in and clock out and, you know, don't don't really understand how it's possible that the people who wield so much power in society don't really seem to have earned it in many cases.
Another class difference between Britain and America that I'd like your opinion on is that in America, politicians only ever talk about the middle class. It's not really done to talk about the working class, but possibly a little bit. Whereas in Britain, with the Labour Party and so on, talking about the working class, the idea of working class solidarity is very, fundamental to our politics. Does that change as America becomes more of a place of class warfare? Do you see working class solidarity, particularly as, you know, trade union support now moves towards the right? What happens with that?
Yeah, well, you know, I've seen several surveys on how Americans identify themselves. And, you know, the vast majority of Americans identify as middle class. You know, the waiter who earns $40,000 a year identifies as middle class, and the investment banker who makes $400,000 a year identifies as middle class. And everyone's middle class, except for people who are sort of at the destitute, the dispossessed at the bottom, and then the kind of 1% millionaires and billionaires at the top. But everyone else is just, you know, so working class as an idea, I think Americans know the term, they're familiar with it. And, you know, I think if you sort of question them about sort of differences between, you know, a truck driver who earns $50,000 a year versus a school teacher, that there are sort of class divisions despite earnings being the same, that there is a difference between going to college or university and working a white collar job versus not going to college and working a blue collar job, even if the income is the same, the lifestyles, the outlook, the opinions, the preferences, all those things differ. I don't know if I think it's becoming more apparent over time that there is this divide, especially among people who go to elite universities and people who don't. But I don't know. I still think that Americans will cling to that middle class label. It's just something inherent in the national DNA.
One thing that changed your circumstances a lot was your experience in the military. And traditionally in Britain, certainly in Britain in the 18th and 19th century with the Navy and always with the Army, the military armed forces has been a great vehicle for upward social mobility. That's probably still true in America, is it not? The military is an area in which people can change their circumstances.
Yeah. I mean, it has historically been an engine for upward mobility. You know, people who maybe aren't in a position to go straight to university can do an enlistment or two, and the military offers generous tuition benefits, cover expenses for higher education. And, you know, in the U.S., it's kind of part of the folklore of the country of, you know, American GIs in World War II coming back home and going to college on the GI Bill. And this helped to bolster, the American middle class. And that, you know, that belief still exists, and it still works. I mean, you can see this, that a lot of people who go into the military do manage to redirect their life path and trajectory, and it offers a place of support for young people, especially young males. I mean, I dwell at length about this in the middling chapters of my book about how, you know, the military is able to channel that sort of raw, untamed young energy, especially young male energy, into something productive and give you sort of goals and ambitions and so on. And it was really effective for me.
Yes. Rob Henderson, I think we'll leave it there, but thank you very much. Great privilege to have you on.
Thank you, Freddie.
That's all for this episode of the Americano podcast. I'd like to thank my brilliant producer, Natasha Ferroz, and urge you to leave a generous, kind, and warm-hearted review of this podcast on whichever platform you listen to it.